Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's being called the Supreme Court's most sweeping ruling on abortion since the early 1990s. Today, the court struck down parts of a Texas law that imposed strict requirements on abortion providers. The law required clinics to meet standards for surgical centers and that doctors performing abortions have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. But in a 5-3 ruling, the high court said those restrictions went too far. And today's decision could have major implications for similar laws in other states. Well, joining us now with more is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Today, she joins us from Aspen, Colorado. Judge Gertner, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. So first of all, I mean, do you agree with the assessment that seems to be making the rounds that this is the biggest abortion-related decision in 15, 20 more years from the high court?
It really is. I most of the abortion restrictions have been upheld by the court, at least since the mid 90s. Restrictions on what you have to say to a woman who's getting an abortion, restrictions on minors' abortions, on the procedures later on in the pregnancy. This is the first time the court really stopped that trend, which was remarkable. It was almost as if the court was saying this is a bridge too far.
Well, the court specifically looked back at a 1992 case, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey, and they applied a standard that was referred to in that case to the Texas case today, of that of placing an undue burden on women receiving access to an abortion. Explain to us what's going on there.
Well, Casey was a case actually that involved spousal consent and other issues that I was talking about that really go later in the pregnancy. But the court, first of all, in Casey reaffirmed Roe v. Wade, which was extraordinary. And it said that the critical issue is no longer what trimester the pregnancy is in, but really is the fetus viable. And with respect to any regulation, the court had to ask whether or not it was an undue burden, meaning did it pose was its purpose or effect to pose substantial obstacles in the way of a woman's right to get an abortion, and that anything that imposes those kinds of obstacles represented an undue burden.
So the purpose and effect in this case, though, for Texas, is that many of the abortion providers in the state couldn't live up to those restrictions, so just closed down.
Right. And what was interesting about it is the court was saying, so many things about this was interesting. One was the court was saying just because the Texas legislature said this is for women's health doesn't mean a court can't second guess that. And the court is going to go and hold hearings on whether or not it actually does burden the right to choose and whether there is any benefit. And it went through a very careful analysis and said, this is clearly a burden. Numbers of clinics were going to shut down. Numbers were going to have to, it's going to wind up being like 6 or 7 clinics in all of Texas when you combine the two restrictions. And in addition, they concluded there was, in fact, no real benefit to a woman's health. The abortion facilities had a lower rate of complications than the ambulatory care facilities. So there was no net gain to women's health here. But it's really not just, first of all, these are restrictions that are cropping up all around the country. They're called restrictions that are limited to abortion providers, right? So all of a sudden, a host of restrictions for abortion providers. And so this provides a model for those challenges. It's a court saying, we're actually going to look carefully at burdens and benefits here. We're not going to accept what the legislature says and their labels. And that's what's remarkable. And in one sense, it's sort of the first decision in a long time reaffirming pre-viability abortions, saying, pre-viability, this is really not a complex procedure, a low rate of complications. And you really have to go a ways before you can impose these kinds of restrictions on it.
Well, let me ask you what effect this ruling may have on similar laws in other states, because there has been some very significant pushback to the court's 5-3 decision today. Texas Senator John Cornyn said that today's ruling sets a dangerous precedent for states like Texas, which the Constitution makes clear should be free to pass laws that are in the best interests of our citizens. And Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, said the decision erodes states' lawmaking authority to safeguard the health and safety of women and subjects more innocent life to being lost. I mean, is this going to have an automatic effect on laws passed in other states?
there's no automatic effect in the sense that what the court is doing is crediting the findings of a district court that the benefits of these restrictions are non-existent and the burdens are substantial. So any like findings would have to be made nationwide. But on the other hand, it certainly creates a disincentive to it, or should create a disincentive to a legislature trying to implement something like this. It's not a surprise that the state officials would talk about the state's rights to protect its citizens. Two problems about that. The state doesn't have a right to protect its citizens when doing so violates the U.S. Constitution. And second, the court found this wasn't protection. Mm. This was not for the purpose of maternal health. In fact, maternal health was undermined by these provisions.
But as always, I mean, those opponents of abortion rights would say there is no right to an abortion protected by the Constitution.
Well, if you're going to go all the way back to Roe v. Wade, yes, that I suppose if you challenge Roe v. Wade, that might be true. But the Casey decision from 1992, which was an O'Connor decision, reaffirmed Roe v. Wade. This decision by 5-3 is reaffirming Roe v. Wade. That discussion, it seems to me, is or should be over.
Well, clearly it is not in America, though. I mean, I don't think the discussion of abortion is a long time until that will be over. But let me just ask you, here in Massachusetts, what effect could today's Supreme Court decision have on Massachusetts law?
Well, Massachusetts abortion rights are protected under the state constitution. So if Roe v. Wade were overturned tomorrow, it wouldn't make any difference in Massachusetts at all, because there are protections under the state constitution. As I understand it, there are actually very few, if any, regulations like what Texas passed here. To the credit of our legislature, there's been no effort to essentially undermine the right to choose by the back door. That's what these regulations are, just by the back door. So I don't think it will immediately affect anything. There's legislation now pending in Congress to try to prohibit regulations like this from taking effect anywhere in the country. Who knows where that will go. But in Massachusetts, I don't think it will make a difference, because we're already protected under the state constitution. Hmm.
Well, I'm speaking with Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and WBUR's legal analyst, about today's major cases decided at the Supreme Court. It's been quite an end of the court term here the past couple of weeks. Judge Gertner, let's talk about another case that the court decided today, and that's the case of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonald. The court ruled on a corruption case involving him. I mean, he had received gifts from a businessman in exchange for providing him with access to government officials and the governor's mansion, and he was prosecuted for that. The court ruled today unanimously that providing access does not constitute an official act under federal statute. So this could have a far-reaching implications for political corruption cases, could it not?
It surely can. It was actually, it was a unanimous decision, which says something about the strength of the decision. No other opinions in it. They called Governor McDonald's conduct tawdry. There was no question about that. But Chief Justice Roberts made it clear that the one indicia of representative democracy is that constituents can call their elected officials and get access and get meetings and find out who to talk to, et cetera. And that may be even in exchange for campaign contributions and even in exchange for money, as here. The official, when you're giving money to a politician that constitutes bribery, you have to be getting in exchange a specific and focused official act.
Okay.
Let me put it this way. It's, you know, being invited to the governor's mansion for dinner might benefit your business, but unless the governor is calling up the official in charge and saying, you know, give this guy the business, it is not bribery.
But Nancy, let me ask you to narrow it down to a specific and focused act in return, and that then is the entire definition of corruption. Doesn't that leave, honestly, the door open rife for a rife exploitation of that? Like, I mean, I can imagine any politician saying, I didn't do X, that specific thing, in return for Y. I mean,
There's no question about that. There's no question about that. But what the court is saying, and I actually wrote an amicus brief supporting Governor McDonald, I might add, what the court is saying is, if you want to do more, you have to be clear about it. In other words, if we want to regulate gifts to politicians in exchange for access and the phone call, then we have to say so. The existing statute talks about official acts in a way that the court said focuses only on, you know, specific official acts in exchange for money. Not, you know, I hate to put it this way, the Lincoln bedroom discussion, right?
Mm.
Not only that, a couple of weeks ago, the Republican Party sent out a missive, which Governor Baker actually rejected, saying that if you make a campaign contribution to Governor Baker, you could get to meet with him, right? If you want to make that illegal, you make it illegal specifically. You don't put it under the cover of a statute that was intended to cover something else. So your comments are exactly on point. But the way to address that through the criminal law is through clear and specific statutes.
Well, that seems like a very tall order, though, because, I mean, you're, the very people who would be subject to that law are the ones that would have to create the law to begin with.
Well, it may be a tall order, but, you know, that's the way we have to do it, because the notion here is that when you leave this up to individual prosecutors to figure out where on the continuum of acts, you know, from I'm giving you money and I'm going to give you the contract to I'm giving you the money, but can you give me a list of people to call? If it's up to a prosecutor to determine where the criminal line is on that continuum, we've given enormous discretion to the prosecutors. If you want to make it clear, the legislature has to make it clear.
Well, Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst. She's also a retired federal judge and a current senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, helping us wrap up a quite eventful term at the United States Supreme Court. Judge Gertner, thank you so much.
Thank you.